Are you interested in radio? Community-based media? You can join CJSF 90.1. We're a volunteer-run community radio station, and we always have space for new volunteers to become programmers, review music, edit audio, and so much more. All the training is provided, and anyone can join. To volunteer, email our volunteer coordinator, Noel, at vol_4_CJSF@sfu.ca. Again, that's vol_4_CJSF@sfu.ca. Or you can visit our website, cjsf.ca. It's CJSF 90.1, diverse, independent, and yours.
Welcome to the Canadian Philosophy Show. My name is Mihai Kovacer. I'm here with a couple of guests to talk to me today, Aaron Wang and Brendan Brownlee, to talk about the importance and the value of public discourse and how we can come to cultivate the ideas that are worth sharing in the public sphere, tying in some ideas of moral progress, tying in some ideas of existentialism, coming off the tail of this mini-series that we've started recently here on the show, and making reference to a work that I wrote last year entitled Individuation as the Cure for Modern Discontent. Now, this is not a published work. I'm not claiming to be some kind of expert author, but it is a work on the topic that I have written, and I think it would be interesting to sort of get into that discussion today, talk a little bit about what I meant in the paper and how it ties into some various philosophical concepts that we've been bringing up on this show for quite a while now. So with that, I guess what I will begin by doing is turning it to, I'll give a summary of my work first of all and the kind of ideas I want to touch on, and then I'll pass it over to my co-hosts here to ask any questions. They've read the work in advance, and so if you have any questions, clarifying questions, anything like that, we can start in that vein. In this work, I can read the introduction to the work for you, just as a sort of introduction to the piece. So I write, quote, "The perspective on the typical modern liberal individual on the political sphere is characterized either by a deep-seated dissatisfaction or a strong apathy toward political affairs. What can be gleaned from a comparison of Kierkegaard's Fear and Trembling and Mill's On Liberty is a place of reconciliation between being a modern individual and existing in an organized political community that brings forward individuation as the cure for this malaise. As many authors will reiterate, political organization is key to the sustainable success of a social group, but this is only insofar as that politicization allows and encourages individuals to communicate their opinions and values to propel social and moral progress." So a couple of ideas in that. First of all, I'm comparing two authors in this work, Kierkegaard, Søren Kierkegaard, and John Stuart Mill, talking about what it means, first of all, by individuation. I mean what we spoke about on our last episode of the Existentialist miniseries, which is really that kind of dive within yourself to discover what are your values, what ideas do you have to share. And then Mill, in On Liberty, writes a lot about the process that comes afterwards of meeting in the public sphere, of talking to each other, and of sharing those ideas, and why that is so valuable for making moral progress. Because if we don't talk to each other and if we don't share those ideas, we don't really have a way of adjusting or refining or changing the way that we interact with each other, the way we think, the way we see things. That's the idea behind the work. I begin in the first half talking about Kierkegaard, talking about his teleological suspension of the ethical, the night of faith. I won't dive too much into this, seeing as we do have another episode on it, so I'll refer the audience to that if you want to know more. And in the second half, like I mentioned, I talk about Mill, about the kind of draconian society in which he was writing as far as social norms and discussion is concerned, and then his warning against tyranny of the majority and unspoken opinions being sort of swallowed up in this society that gets almost too big for its own britches. I'll turn it to my co-hosts here to refer to me any questions, refer to parts of the work that I can further sort of expand upon, and then we can sort of get into the discussion from there.
I was wondering if you could, specifically in the context of this paper, if you could elaborate on the tyranny of the majority. I have a follow-up question depending on what that means specifically, but I'd be curious to hear more about that.
As I mentioned, in the Victorian era in which Mill was writing, the environment was quite strongly, I think draconian is a good word for it as far as social norms are concerned. And I think what he feared, I quote here, saw an idea that de Tocqueville, Alexis de Tocqueville talks about, and then Mill as well. They talk about, quote, what de Tocqueville and Mill had both remarked was that democracy, despite its rapidly growing appeal as a liberator from direct tyranny, was actually a source of indirect tyranny. This, de Tocqueville dubbed as tyranny of the majority. The idea is that a democracy may have the advantage of, again, taking away the direct tyranny of an autocratic leader, of rules that actually stifle people's ability to live their lives in whatever way they wish, but you end up with an environment in which majority opinions can very strongly dictate the norms and the behavior in that society. And so you get a kind of either tyranny of the majority in the sense legally, where there's a kind of decision that is dictated by the majority, such as, of course, electing the leader, or tyranny of the majority just in the marketplace of ideas, where a very strong majority opinion can drown out other ideas or other perspectives. And that's what I go to talk about a little bit further in the piece.
Interesting, because that sounds kind of related to an idea that Kierkegaard has in another work. I mean, you cite Fear and Trembling in here, but in his work Two Ages, or The Two Ages, he has this notion of a leveling public. Are you familiar with that?
I believe I've encountered the idea, but not in great depth, so I'd appreciate you expanding on that.
Leveling is a kind of social process in which all things in their particularity or their individuality are kind of leveled down to sameness, and specifically it's down to a sameness in spirit. That is a sort of indifference between things. People are just kind of the same or whatever. But he says, so I'm quoting here, "For leveling really to take place, a phantom must first be raised, the spirit of leveling, a monstrous abstraction, an all-encompassing something that is nothing, a mirage. And this phantom is the public." So it's interesting that Mill and de Tocqueville also are talking about a kind of mass social group that has a kind of indirect sway over particular individuals, because the public threatens to level down any particular individual by just saying, well, you're just like, you know, we can create these social categories or whatever and just say that you're just another one of these or anything like that. You're individual insofar as you're the same as the rest of these guys, and that's kind of the leveling process. But it's interesting because in Mill and de Tocqueville, there seems to be something essentially dangerous about the tyranny of the majority. I think this is where Kierkegaard kind of comes in to help Mill a little bit too, is that for Kierkegaard, you can have a majority not leveled down. You can have a majority of individuals come up and say, we want to do this, but that's distinct from a leveling public. So I wonder if Mill and de Tocqueville are kind of jumping the gun by pointing at a majority and saying that, you know, there's something necessarily bad about a majority, but Kierkegaard is saying it's the way that a group goes about kind of being in their communities. I think it's interesting because it's something I'm still teasing out about de Tocqueville and Mill, because I think they're gesturing towards that as well. It's the way they do it. When you say that, it has to do with the indirect nature of it.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I think that's a good point. So there's two notes I want to make there. First of all, I do have a couple of quotes in here from Mill on that subject. So firstly, he says, "The only purpose for which power can be rightfully exercised over any member of a civilized community against his will is to prevent harm to others." So that might sound familiar to audiences, the harm principle, right? That you can only impinge on the freedom of others in order to prevent them harming yet another. And similarly, he says, "So the only freedom that deserves the name is that of pursuing our good in our own way, so long as we do not attempt to deprive others of theirs." And so I think what happens is the majority
has this potential to impinge on the way in which the minority lives their lives, insofar as they dictate some rules or norms or ways of doing in that society, in that group, that could be harmful in some ways. And I think that's that idea. And as far as that goes back to Kierkegaard, I think what really interested me about comparing these two authors is that at first they seem like polar opposites. I mean, Mill is talking about the public, about discussion, about moral progress. Kierkegaard says, no. To each their own, dive into yourself, become your own knight of faith, ignore the rational and go so far as the absurd in the name of faith, and that's morality, right? And that's the existentialist perspective. But once I started to read a little bit into both of these authors, what I find is that there's kind of a middle ground here where, first of all, there's ideas, like you point out, of Kierkegaard's, like this public, which may or may not be harmful depending on how it exercises its force. But second of all, they work in a two-step process to me. The first of which is Kierkegaard's finding yourself and finding your values, and the second step is Mill's go out into the public and share those ideas. And so we'll break that apart a little bit as we go in the conversation here, but that's where I saw a connection between the two authors, and that's the sort of source connection of this piece.
I do want to chime in here with a couple of points. On page 6 of your paper, you have a long section describing the details of your argument. And then in the next paragraph, you start with the sentence, "What this allows is a society in which pluralism and democratic equity are used to their best potential." So can you talk a little bit about what pluralism means in this context?
Yeah, essentially. So in the previous paragraph, I'm basically describing Mill's conception of freedom, Mill's idea of going out into the public and speaking to each other. I say what Mill posited is that true successful politicization is the ability to go out into the world and converse with one's fellow citizens in an arena in which all opinions are allowed and heard with due respect. In that sense, pluralism, I mean in the term, you know, in the sense in which I believe it's typically used in political philosophy, talking about people of different beliefs, backgrounds, lifestyles, participating equally in the public, in political society, coexisting, sharing their ideas. So that kind of pluralism of ideas. And so here, when I say what this allows a society in which pluralism and democratic equality are used to their best potential, what I mean is that pluralism doesn't have to be a source of conflict, but can be a source of progress when those ideas are given the time of day, essentially, when everyone can share their ideas equally, and then those ideas can be discussed, debated, and the best way forward chosen from them.
Interesting. When I was talking to Brandon before the show, I asked him kind of the same question, and he said that this is very different from Plato's Republic, that pluralism is not something that would necessarily be compatible with that type of philosophy. So what is the alternative to pluralism? Is it kind of the belief that you should have a society that tries to achieve one goal and doesn't allow for more individuation?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think when I'm talking about pluralism, it does mean that there are a number of perspectives that coexist. And so in that sense, it might be what's sort of distracting from the idea of a common goal. But I think multiple perspectives can coexist and still collaborate. I mean, it's not that we have to live in a society where each person that has a different perspective from themselves does their own thing and they can group into communities and find their own goals. That's quite defeating the purpose of what I'm trying to say, actually. Rather, what has to happen, and this is where I draw on Mill most strongly, is that you can have a pluralistic society, and in fact, that can be a very good thing as long as those ideas that come from varying perspectives are shared, and then you decide as a group on the goal that you want to pursue based on that variety of interests, of ideas. And then as far as individuation is concerned, finding your own values and knowing your own values, I think, again, that'll be influenced very strongly by the kind of group that you live with and interact with, be that ethnic or socioeconomic or what have you. But what's important is that people know enough about themselves and their own ideas and values to be able to share them coherently and take a stance on things, maybe open to have their minds changed, but taking that stance and then, again, finding common ground or finding the way forward in the public.
I think what is so interesting about these ideas for me specifically is that in a Canadian context, this seems like common sense in a way. This seems what kind of like why we should have parliamentary democracy. But I think for many other people in other countries, that would not be the case. I think that especially if you think of collectivist societies, there are societies that have normative principles about what is and what is not socially acceptable. And that's not something that is easily changed or not. It's hard to see if you took that away from that society, whether or not you'd still have the same functional society. And it's kind of the same question that economists have of when they want to create an experiment and say, well, let's try this new economic system. Well, the only way to know to say if that's good or not is to kind of try it and try that experiment. But if you do that experiment wrong, then you've kind of destroyed a whole country and a whole economy. So the same kind of thing with social questions and moral questions. It's one thing to say that, you know, this would be moral progress or social progress for our society. Would it necessarily be social progress for collectivist society?
Yeah, I don't think it would necessarily. First of all, I think it's important to distinguish between this broad conceptual term of collectivist or collectivism and the kind of political systems that could be in place for those societies, because there is a wide variety of certain states which we would maybe characterize as collectivist, culturally speaking, do operate within democratic systems of various forms.
Japan
possibly
would
within
be an example of that.
Yeah, exactly. So you have countries like Japan, whereas other countries that are quote-unquote collectivist might not have that same political system, but that, first of all, there's, I think, a distinction between the philosophical aspect of this, the social, the cultural aspect of this, and the political aspect of this. But, and what that, why I make that distinction is because, yeah, I think I specifically am using this idea of individuation as a tool in our society or societies like ours, because I think if we call ourselves individualist or atomist or however you want to describe our society by comparison to collectivist, then I think this is a plausible way to encourage or to use, like I said, pluralism and diversity to its best potential, because you are able, so in our society, you know, you have individuals who consider themselves to be a more important, say, level of action and of perspective than the collective. And so it would be helpful to use the process of individuation to sort of dive into yourself again, find those values, and then share them and debate. That would be a helpful tool for us. Whereas, like you say, in another society that already has some different social norms based on putting the collective ahead of the individual, this could be disruptive in a sense, and in a way that maybe isn't beneficial. So yes, I do mean specifically in our context, let's say Canadian, American, maybe British and British influenced at large, though again, the political systems within those also vary. And so how you're going to put it into practice politically might be different, but I think the philosophical underpinning is applicable across contexts.
And the point that I was making to draw that out a little bit more, it's not that a collectivist society wouldn't necessarily have progress from becoming a more individualized society. That could be possible, but there is a lot of additional complexity there that I don't think that your paper was intended to look for. So
yeah.
I think that was just a useful.
Yeah, and the idea of progress in this case, it's an interesting thing to, I think it is a good point to bring it up, because I do talk about progress as the sharing of ideas and the changing of perspective over time to satisfy the needs of that society and the individuals that interact with each other within it. And so I don't mean to say that progress is only possible in that way, or that it's the best way to move forward, or that other societies that wouldn't take this kind of path would be unable to progress. I don't think I'm certain I didn't intend to say any of that, but as you say, the paper is only focuses, the scope is only so large. What I do mean by progress in this case and in our context is, again, the sharing of ideas and the bringing of them into the public sphere. And I want to add one more point, which is that the reason I say that, and Mill makes a really good point of this, he says that there are certain ideas. So there are ideas, there are facts that can be right or wrong. There are ideas based on those facts, and there are sort of value ideas that, you know, could be more or less useful for a given society, and those can be held by anyone. It could be held by the majority, it could be held by a minority, it could be held by one person. And so the problem, what you get is sometimes he acknowledges that you'll get situations where one person has an idea that's really good, but everyone else disagrees with that particular idea. And it's not until some years later when that idea resurfaces and then is accepted and integrated into that society and they make some kind of political or social change. So it's possible for good ideas or useful normative claims to be ignored, though I think what he's saying is that eventually those ideas will tend to resurface and be readapted when the time is right for that particular society. So, and that's why it's so important to share ideas out in the public, because if that idea were never shared, if that person didn't have the platform to share that idea, even if they're the only person that holds it, that society might wipe that idea out without ever even having heard it. And that could be a real barrier to progress, moral progress in this instance.
Yeah, I think that's a good qualification. I was going to ask too about a bit more about what you meant by progress, but I think those are good qualifications. It gives a general picture about how you see progress with Mill, or what kind of progress Mill wants to have come about through this kind of discourse or this open discourse.
Yeah, and I'll say, of course, Mill was a utilitarian, right? So it's pretty easy for him, when your idea of morality is what creates the most utility, it's pretty easy to say, okay, progress is characterized by, you know, finding ideas that are of increasing utility over the course of time. So I will say that much, that it's easier, I think, for him to make that argument than it is for someone who's not a utilitarian. Again, though, that's why I think this discussion is very interesting, because I am not a utilitarian. And yet, I think that a similar process could be applied and moral progress made. And I think the way that that can come about, that I think what's necessary for that to come about, though, is people being sufficiently in touch with their own ideas of morality, with their own values, that they can bring new information to the arena and have those be discussed and then maybe accepted by a wider diversity of people and then integrated and to the betterment of that community. And so that's where I think I integrate, like I said, Kierkegaard into the first part of that process.
Yeah. And I'm glad you kind of come mask off here, and because I should say too, I'm not entirely a utilitarian either, but there's also an interesting member in this discussion that isn't a utilitarian also, and that's Kierkegaard.
Yeah.
He would absolutely, I think one of the, if I could bring like a criticism to this, it's that I think Kierkegaard would be interested in the use of this inward journey that you can kind of synthesize with Mill. He might see, you know, finding your own values and finding your subjective truth as a kind of prerequisite for going into the marketplace of ideas and being able to have discussions about this kind of thing. I think he would find that a bit, I think he'd find it a bit suspect, even if I do think it would be useful. And I share the same intuition with you. I think that there can be some kind of moral progress, even if it's a sharing of things like irreconcilable subjective truths or something like that. These two, you know, you can still have that kind of discussion, and you can still have some kind of moral progress, even if the, you know, the lines will never become entirely parallel or overlap. There, that stuff can come from that, even though it's a asymptotic kind of discussion.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And I would agree. I think it's quite possible that Kierkegaard, if not both authors, would be suspect of what I'm trying to say here. But I think that's okay. And but it is a good criticism. I would say you might be wondering, how does Kierkegaard's notion of subjectivity, the idea that it's to each their own journey and to each their own faith, how is that? Why am I synthesizing that with Mill's idea of the public sphere of discussion? But I think at the end of the day, I have to be realistic about this. I mean, we live in a society in which we have to compromise with the people who live around us and collaborate where necessary to live good lives. And I think many times it's the case that we will share some values with our community. That's, I think, what we would all hope. And that we can agree on some ideas with our neighbors and all that kind of thing. But at the end of the day, there will be some things that we disagree on wide scales. And I mean, that's the notion of political competition, right? I mean, there are parties and individuals representing those parties who, at least in a parliamentary system and, you know, presidential system, in which their platform is based on the structuring of values, a different hierarchy of values than the other parties. So, you know, the Conservative Party, for example, of Canada may have certain economic interests held more highly than the ones held by the Liberal Party. And that's what differentiates the parties, right? But at the end of the day, a party has to be elected and a leader has to be elected. And sometimes the best we can do is the majority electing the person that they think represents their interests best, because you're not going to be able to satisfy every single person with a single platform. But what's important, I think, in this discussion is, even if that is the case, the way you mitigate that danger of tyranny of the majority is by allowing everyone, regardless of what camp they're in and what kind of person they are, to have a platform where they can share their own ideas and where their ideas can be debated. And I think that's what I really am trying to get at, is that if you don't have that platform, that's where things go wrong real fast, because the majority that elected a certain way of running society for a certain period of time can impose some rules and some laws and some decisions on the rest of the people who are not part of that majority that can be harmful. But as long as everyone has that platform to share their values and their ideas, changes can be made and decisions can be made that make the situation more tolerable, if not actually like positive and beneficial for a larger group of people than just, say, the majority. Just before I pass it off to my hosts to respond to that, I'll remind our audience that you are listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show. You can find the show at tcps.podbean.com. So on Podbean, if you look up the Canadian Philosophy Show, you can find episodes like this, like the Existentialist miniseries that we've been mentioning, and others. That is essentially what I was aiming for with this paper, is an idea of political cooperation and interaction in a public sphere that is meaningful because people know enough about themselves and their own values to bring new ideas to the stage.
I do think that it's something that we really need today, is more reasons for open discourse. Because I think it's becoming increasingly easier in the modern day with technology to kind of find your group, your tribe, who kind of your little echo chamber that agrees with most of what you think, and then to kind of stop there. But I think the unfortunate thing is that when a lot of people do that, and I think that's mainly an unconscious process for most people, unless they do some philosophical reflection, I think what's unfortunate about that is it cuts them off from the type of inner discoveries and searching and inquiry that Kierkegaard is talking about, that to you, where you kind of search within yourself to find your own values, search out your own ideas, and then come forth and share them with a community, understanding that some people may not agree with you, and that that's okay, because at the end of the day, what you're aiming for is not to get other people to agree with you, but to kind of further a conversation and kind of looking for progress, for an interchange of ideas to kind of get a better outcome and a better idea in the future.
Yeah. And I want to bring in another aspect of this here that we haven't quite touched on yet, which is, so I call this the, you know, like I said, individuation is the cure for modern discontent. And in my introduction, I specifically say discontent towards political affairs. So that's what I'm referring to, is political apathy. And I wrote another paper this year. I was a research or a review paper on voter turnout. And so, and I found that there's sort of two dominant camps that debate on what influences voter turnout, the first being that is institutional factors, things like registration laws and that kind of thing that influences voter turnout most. But the other camp, and that's what's relevant here,